This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in America. Coming up, Erlene McMichael interviews the director of a new documentary about suicide survivors. Western Michigan University's Lee Honors College will be showing the film this month as part of a mental health lecture series. But first, there are several investigations going on right now examining how Michigan State University handled allegations of sexual assault and abuse. Two of those are being conducted in the state legislature. Kalamazoo State Representative John Hoadley is the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Subcommittee for Higher Education. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Representative Hoadley joins us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. What exactly should the legislature be looking for as they investigate Michigan State?
It's so important that we're putting the survivors and the victims of abuse at the center of all the work we're trying to do. At the end of the day, our goal should be to make sure that we help in the healing of those folks however possible. And at the same time, we need to be figuring out what were the systemic failures that led to literally dozens of young girls and women being abused. So we need to be then taking those lessons and offering them and requiring them to be put in place at our other institutions across the state to try to prevent these types of tragedies from happening in the future. And the other piece of this is that we need to remember that this wasn't just one terrible man. As public media reports have now showcased, there was failures at multiple levels in that system about who was reporting and across multiple departments. And so we need to ensure that we are keeping our scope broad enough to tackle the culture that allowed this sort of tragedy to continue for too long.
Attorney General Bill Schuette is also investigating Michigan State. Are there certain areas where the legislature should look and Attorney General Bill Schuette should look? Should there be coordination here, or should you just kind of go about your business and see what you both find out?
I think that we should be ensuring that we're trying to get the broadest realm of investigation possible. I mean, the legislative branch, our duty is to hold the institutions accountable to the public. And the type of work that we're going to be doing is looking for institutional change that can occur. We want to be good stewards of the taxpayers, and we also want to make sure that we're protecting all of our constituents when they're attending these institutions. Now, that may differ from the type of investigation that Bill Schuette may undertake. He may be looking for additional criminal or civil penalties. His investigation will be up to him. But I'm excited to work with Representative Lasada, Representative Kesto, and Representative Chang in particular on the committee to be figuring out what are the both the legal and the legislative remedies that we may be able to put in place to prevent or reduce these types of tragedies in the future.
As I said, you are on the House Appropriations Subcommittee. You're the ranking Democrat for higher education. Should the legislature be looking at actually using the power of the purse here to get Michigan State or other universities to comply with, say, sharing records and, other material that might shed light on what has happened?
So I come from a family of educators. Actually, both my parents were university professors and administrators. A lot of other folks in my family, my sister, cousins, aunts, are teachers of some sort. So education is incredibly important to me. I do believe, though, that we need to be using all of the tools in our toolbox to try to get the answers that'll help keep victims and survivors whole and also prevent tragedies in the future. But let's also remember one key point here. As we use the power of the purse to ensure that we get these answers, families across Michigan, across the country that are sending their students here, they're the ones who are increasingly picking up a larger bill to go to school. So we have to make sure that if we're using the appropriations process, it's incredibly targeted. So we're holding those administrators accountable and not penalizing the students and their families who are the ones left paying tuition bills.
Attorney General Bill Schuette came out the other day and said that he thought that the governor of Michigan should be appointing members to the Michigan State University Board of Trustees, as well as the University of Michigan and Board of Regents and the Wayne State University Board of Governors. You were pretty quick to say that you didn't think that was a good idea. You said your initial reaction is that sounds like Bill Schuette trying to play politics, according to a quote in the Gongra News Service. What's wrong with the idea that the governor should be appointing members of the Michigan State Board of Trustees?
So in an era where we should be demanding more accountability in our political process, Attorney General Schuette was advocating to literally take choices away from voters. And, you know, this is an example of why we have some independence, but why voters then have a direct say in who ultimately sits on those boards. Because every voter, regardless of what party you are, should be looking and knowing the names and figuring out who's up for election, because our trustees that were elected failed us. I hope more of them resign. I hope that folks who think that they can bring something of value to the trustees at MSU, but also to all of our Board of Regents and Board of Governors, that they step forward and raise their hand. In 2018, we're in a time where we should be seeing more people getting involved. If there's one lesson that folks have learned, it's that we can't sit back. We have to be involved and actively engaged in our government. So when Attorney General Schuette was advocating to take choices away from voters, you know, that to me rings very hollow. And instead, we should be saying, how do we actually increase accountability? How do we put more people in charge of more of the decisions closer to the ground? Because if you talk to people in my district or across the state, they figured it out really early. 20 years at MSU was too long to sweep these victims and survivors under the rug, and frankly explains why we should be having more scrutiny on our trustees by the voters.
But isn't the situation in Michigan pretty unique that there's three universities, Michigan State, Michigan, and Wayne State, where the governing board is elected by a statewide election? The other universities, like Western Michigan University, the board there is appointed by the governor. Does it make sense to have that sort of dual system? I mean, if we should be electing members to Michigan State's board, should we also be electing members to Western's board?
So what we have is a hybrid system in Michigan, where some of our state institutions have more direct governance and influence from the executive branch. And at the same time, when the framers of our Constitution passed our Constitution, they wanted to ensure that we had some institutions that were more directly accountable to the people. And that's in fitting with their missions. You know, when we had the first land grant institution in the country. So we have a long and rich history of making sure that those institutions were set up to serve in a practical way the people of our state. Now, you know, we could talk about other reforms that could be happening at the system, but at the end of the day, we have some balance. And I would also remind us that if we look back over time, the legislature has tried to impede on that independence that our higher education institutions have tried to have. Everything from actively limiting what courses could be offered at universities to trying to limit research opportunities at those universities. So the threat to academic independence and the ability for those institutions to respond to the market forces of what our employers and students need, as well as research that may challenge the status quo, is real. One thing I think I've appreciated about our 15 higher education institutions in the state that are publicly funded is that they have a balance. We have some that are more accountable to voters. We have some that are more accountable to the executive branch. And at the end, all of them are supposed to serve our students and our people.
We are speaking on Wednesday morning. I want to note that because there may be developments that happen after we record, but before people get a chance to hear this, and that may be why we don't talk about them. But there is a report that Michigan State's faculty is considering passing a resolution that would call for the removal of the Board of Trustees. Should the legislature be looking into possible impeachment of members of MSU's board?
I believe that we have to keep all of our options on the table. We need to let the investigation that the legislature will now be undertaking play out. But trustees need to understand that they are being held accountable. In terms of an impeachment process, I think it's definitely worth exploring. We need to see what actions are going to be taken both by the new interim president and by the board. You know, and of course, I am so inspired that I see the faculty really stepping up and leading, which is, for so many of our institutions, the faculty is just the heart and soul of those institutions. And part of that tenure process gives them the independence to hold their leaders accountable when there are systemic failures, like we're seeing at Michigan State University. And I do want to say, I don't say these words lightly. As someone who graduated from Michigan State University, it pains me that the institution let down survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse for so long. So it is, you know, my heart just grieves for all those brave women that came forward, but also for what is clearly going to be thousands of other women and men who have not had, felt like they've had their voice heard in the process for too long. So I say we take nothing off the table. We have to do a thorough investigation. We owe it to the public and to those victims. And we need to then see where those chips fall.
One of the things that Michigan State has been criticized for is secrecy. Should the legislature be looking at the Open Meetings Act, Freedom of Information Act, and how those things apply to state universities and see if those laws are strong enough?
Yes. I mean, let's be very blunt here. Yes, the answer is yes. Also, we should make sure that we're not turning a hypocritical eye. You know, the House passed a bipartisan package that would begin to shed additional light and transparency on how we conduct our business in the state legislature. My good colleague, Representative Jeremy Moss, has been a tireless advocate on those issues. And at the same time that we're taking a look at the failures and what led to those failures, largely due to secrecy at Michigan State University, we should be ensuring that we are giving that same attention to our own House, get those bills through the Senate, get them to the governor's desk.
All right, let me ask you about something else. You have a bill which has been introduced pertaining to bottle deposits. How would this change the way that we pay and collect deposits on what we drink in Michigan?
Michigan really led the way when we talked about increasing recycling rates for our aluminum cans, right, back in the day. And everyone remembers that there was just litter on the side of the road, people throwing cans and bottles out the window. And you know, as a result, it was doing significant environmental damage to our rivers, our lakes, and our lands. So when we passed the bottle deposit law decades ago, it ended up being one of the most successful environmental programs in the country. Nearly 98% of our recyclable materials under the bottle deposit law are recycled, which has prevented literally tons upon tons of garbage from ending up on the sides of our roads and highways and our lakes or in our landfills. So my bottle deposit bill that has been supported by a number of my colleagues in the House would expand what qualifies for that 10-cent deposit. I think the thing that most people are excited about is it would include water bottles. So, you know, we're going to make sure that folks aren't throwing away one-use plastic water bottles, but instead are bringing them back. But from a very technical standpoint, it would include non-carbonated beverages that are in a gallon or less container. So, you know, these are going to be a lot of the bottles and some of the small fruit juices and those sort of items that are currently not included under the deposit law. It does exempt milk, so we're not going to make it any more difficult if someone is worried about, you know, getting a gallon of milk for their family or whatnot. But, you know, for the rest of that, it's going to make sure that we increase those recycling rates.
In his State of the State address last week, Governor Snyder said that his project to boost recycling has been one of the great frustrations of his time as governor and was hoping to get that restarted. Do you think what you're proposing here sort of coincides, that there may be some common ground between at least you and the governor on this?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'll work with anybody from any party if they're working on things that are going to move our state forward. And, you know, when the governor talked about his recycling initiative, both Representative Hammoud, who has a bill that would also expand the type of recycling in apartments, and the bill that I had already ready to go on expanding the bottle deposit law, you know, we said, let's put it in there so it's part of the conversation. We want to be working with Republicans and the governor to do something that's good for our state because, you know, the lack of movement hasn't been just frustrating for the governor. It's been frustrating for a lot of us. So essentially, we recycled a bill from last year. We're hoping to reuse the good legislative arguments that we have ready to go on those bills and reduce legislative delay this time so we actually get the thing passed into law.
Democratic State Representative John Hoadley represents the city of Kalamazoo in the State House. Thank you very much for your time.
Always appreciate being on the show. Thank you.
John Hoadley joined us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing.
This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. Most students who go away to college are starting their support network all over again, at a time that they're also having to live on their own for the first time. And for some, that can lead to depression, even suicide. That's why Western Michigan University Lee Honors College is showing a newly released documentary about suicide. It's called The S Word. The screening is on February 7th. I recently interviewed Lisa Klein, the film's director.
Well, thank you for joining us here on WMUK.
Absolutely.
Where have you been showing it, The S Word?
We have been doing an unusual route because oftentimes with independent films, you start at festivals and then go from there. We're sort of doing everything simultaneously. I'm from Detroit, so we've been back to Detroit a couple of times. We've shown it at University of Michigan. We showed it in Royal Oak. We showed it at MIT. We've been all over. And then a couple of screenings in Canada as well.
What are the stories that we will hear?
Basically, you will hear a lot from actual attempt survivors, people who have attempted to take their lives and survived. And really what our focus is, I mean, I approach this as somebody who lost loved ones to suicide. But what I found is this thriving community of people who had attempted to take their lives, survived, and were basically turning their pain into purpose. So, for example, you'll see Desiree Stage. And she is a photographer. She had attempted to take her life and was on the internet looking for people like her, looking for other people who were struggling with suicidal thoughts, and really didn't find a lot. She found groups of people who had lost people. And so she decided to go out and, as a photographer, to photograph other attempt survivors and tell their stories. And, you know, interview them. And the purpose of this, I mean, the portraits that she took was sort of look into my lens, look into my eyes, because we always look away. Oftentimes, there's the shame and the fear of actually engaging with them. She decided to turn that around. So basically, with these people, I mean, I can tell you who they are and all of that, but it really is about the three-dimensionality of the people in the film and just people in general. So you're not identified with one thing. You're not identified as somebody who attempted suicide. You're not identified that you're, you know, a spelunker and that's all you do in your life. So it really is about showing every, you know, showing the whole person. And so Desiree is one of them. We also have Kalechi, who has she had attempted when she was 23, and she's still struggling. And that's another thing that was really important for us, to show that many people who are dealing with suicidal thoughts, suicidal ideation, people who have attempted suicide, it isn't like it goes away. It isn't like, okay, I'm fine now. Yeah, I attempted suicide and I'm okay, or I'm dealing with depression, but I'm fine. It's about coping mechanisms and how they're going on from here. And also, what was important for me is when you're dealing with a topic like suicide, it isn't like everybody attempts suicide and survives. There are people, unfortunately, who don't. And we have a family of Brandon. We have his mother, father, and sister who actually took his own life a few years ago. And we talked to the family as well.
Now, I just want to, for a moment, address the significance of this type of film in terms of the topic of suicide, that you're doing first-person narratives, that often that this wasn't something that was readily available.
Oh, no. And it was sort of serendipitous that when we started filming, there was this rise where people were starting to listen because there was such fear around this before, like getting people together who had attempted. Leia Harris in the film said at one point, she said, you know, they were afraid to put us in a room together, like we would exchange suicide recipes or something. And it's so not true. It's like when you get these people together and they're talking, value in that. In my family, I lost both my father and my brother to suicide. Emotionally, I think that I did feel like, wow, you know, through these people, there are things that I'm gonna learn in terms of how they were feeling and what they were thinking when they were on the edge. And I feel like there's so much value in that for people who are struggling to see, whether it's the inspiration or hope. But I mean, that really is what it is. I mean, you know, you have somebody like Craig who said, I was done. It was over for me. And I was wrong. You know, so it isn't like he's preaching. It isn't like he's saying, yeah, if I can do it, you can do it. he's just telling his story. He's telling us where he was and where he is now. And there's just a lot to be gained from that, I think.
Who is the audience for this film?
Not to sound too grandiose, but everyone. There are people who think that they don't know anybody or don't know anything. But then I hear about 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds who took their own lives. So once you reach a certain age, you know somebody, or you know somebody who knows somebody. And whether it's feeling enabled, feeling empowered to listen to somebody, because people feel like often, wow, you know, somebody talks to me about their struggles or talks to me about suicide, I better call 911. You know, I better have them, you know, talk to a psychiatrist. Not necessarily, because we all have that power. We all have the power to listen, for sure. So it really is for everyone in terms of feeling less alone yourself, if you yourself have struggled, if you know somebody who is, or knowing the risk factors and the warning signs and all of that. We want it to not be the 10th leading cause of death and the second leading cause of death for 10 to 24-year-olds.
What are the main causes of suicide?
That is such a tough question. So many people feel like it's pretty clear cut, it's mental illness. But no, because we're so complex that the causes, the reasons, all the struggles, all of the stuff is so complex. I mean, you have childhood trauma. You have, you know, when you talk about something like the military and it's like 22 veterans a day die by suicide. I talk to veterans. I talk to military psychiatrists. Many, many of the people who have taken their own lives in the military have never seen combat. So it isn't like, oh, my God, you know, they've seen the worst of the worst. There is certainly that. And there's certainly PTSD, and all of that can come into play. But also what you came into it with, whether it was your relationship issues or things that we all deal with.
Have you found that disconnection is a factor in suicide attempts?
Absolutely. And that was the next thing I was going to say, because feeling connected, feeling like you have a community is so huge for all of us. There's a man named, he's a suicidologist, a psychologist named Thomas Joyner, and he wrote a book called Why People Die by Suicide. And his three reasons are hopelessness, feeling like there's no hope and nowhere to go, burdensomeness, and feeling like you're a burden to others, and really there's nobody there for you. And another one, which I thought was really interesting, and the term is lethality, and feeling like you can do it, because it isn't really our instinct to die. You have a survival instinct, as we all do. There is a whole thing about if you've attempted before, your chances are much greater to actually die by suicide.
You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. We're talking to Lisa Klein, director of a documentary featuring the personal stories of suicide attempt survivors. The S Word will be shown on February 7th at Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo. Something that I'm struck by is in today's society, you know, we have social media of all kinds of ways that we can connect with each other electronically and so on and so forth, but yet people are lonelier than ever.
Absolutely. I call social media the ultimate double-edged sword, because on social media, something like Live Through This, which is what Desiree does with her photographs and all of that, she has these communities that she's built of people who can talk to each other. And they can, and you have the crisis line that you can call, but you also have a crisis text line. You can be anonymous and all of that. And with that, you can be helped, because if you are somebody who is afraid to, you know, whether it's your job or your family or whatever that's preventing you from talking and going out there, which again, the silence is generally the worst possible thing you can do, to not be able to talk about it. But if you have a community of people, even if it's on the internet or whatever, then at least you have that. But on the other hand, it is a breeding ground for isolation. It is a breeding ground, as we've seen, the whole thing with bullying. I don't want to draw a straight line to you're bullied and then you kill yourself, because it is not that. It's far more complex than that. But when we were bullied back in the day when you were on the, you know, recess and somebody was bullying you, you could go home and have a safe haven. There's no safe haven anymore, because it's there 24/7 and, you know, it's loud. The thing about the internet is it's here, and we can't put Pandora back in the box.
So I think part of our work in suicide prevention is figuring out, it's one more tool.
What tools have been effective in keeping people alive?
One is a huge one is connection. Connection is huge. And some people, you know, therapy can help, meditation. Everybody, again, is so different. And there are people who are averse to therapy and they're averse to medication. They don't want to do it. I would to say averse to therapy is because finding a therapist, it's almost like dating, you know, because, you know, there are people who are like, well, I can't go to somebody because they didn't listen to me or they were horrible or whatever. It could take a while, just like it could take a while to find the right medication. Or it's possible the medication isn't for you. We talk to a lot of experts. It isn't that one thing is a panacea. Generally, it's, you know, five things or eight things or three, you know, whatever the combination is that works for you, because we're all so different. Also, a huge thing is understanding that it's okay to not be okay, because so many of us feel like, oh my God, if I'm feeling, you know, depressed, or if somebody's feeling a certain way, then there's the shame in that, like, oh my God, I'm not okay. And it's not okay to not be okay, but it is. And figuring out how you're going to best cope with not being okay. Not necessarily getting to the point of, okay, I'm going to take this pill and then I'm going to be okay. It's figuring out, okay, what am I going to do today to get through today? Because I you know, I need to get to this point and I need to be safe.
You were talking about how you've shown the film at a lot of universities. I thought I read somewhere that mental illness sometimes can manifest around the age that students start college.
Absolutely. And what's important to us is finding out what is available on campus. Are there people available to talk to? So knowing if there's a peer group on your campus, if you know, counseling and all of that, because it is such a vulnerable age, because you're leaving home for the first time and you're in a new environment. Oftentimes people go to college and don't know anybody. So it really is finding your people, finding your peers, finding the people who are going to be there for you, because your parents aren't there generally. But again, you're in this new environment, and being able to talk to your teachers if things are too difficult. And if you isolate and decide that you're going to get through this and you're going to be okay and you're going to study for this test and you're going to stay up all night and you're going to take whatever you need to take, it's probably not going to end well. Like, I feel like part of orientation, there's got to be, you know, it's like, okay, now you know where the student union is, you know where this is, you know where this is, you know where your advisor is, you know where your peer groups are, you know your support groups, all of that. It should all be woven in, because it isn't this or that. It's this and that.
Lastly, there's an online resource I noticed on the S-Word website. It's called 13 Reasons Why Not, short videos of suicide attempt survivors who are thanking people who were instrumental in keeping them alive. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It started in Oxford, Michigan, actually. And so there was this show, 13 Reasons Why.
I'm sorry, is this project affiliated with you all or no?
It's not affiliated with us. I do think what they're doing is incredible. They were not happy with 13 Reasons Why. It was a TV series about a high school student who took her own life, and she made a tape for everybody who she felt wronged her. So what this group of high school students did was they turned that upside down. And they said, for example, you know, Sarah, you sat up with me all night and you listened to me. You listened to me and you were there for me. Sarah, you're one of the reasons why not. You're one of the reasons why I did not kill myself. So when I talk about having groups on campus, it's whatever works for this particular group. I mean, having people who can get together, not necessarily just online, but people who can actually connect with each other, because you're all in this together.
Ms. Klein, thank you so much for your time and much success with your project.
Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me do this.
A free screening of the S-Word documentary is planned for 7 p.m. Wednesday, February 7th at Chenery Auditorium in Kalamazoo. It'll be followed by a discussion with Lisa Klein, who directed the film. For resources and more information about this event that Western Michigan University Lee Honors College is sponsoring, go to wmuk.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Arlene McMichael.